After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up now that spring is here, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. So what's the right amount of socializing for you? Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. It's a great way to build relationship skills, figure out your goals, and so much more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/BeHereNow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/BeHereNow.
Welcome to the Krishnadas Pilgrim Heart Hour. In this podcast, Krishnadas shares his warm-hearted and down-to-earth path to the divine. If you are interested in supporting Krishnadas' podcast, please go to BeHereNowNetwork.com/KD.
Howdy.
Howdy. Howdy. Terrible traffic on the west side, Veterans Day.
Uh-huh. Everybody leaving for Canada.
A creature was wound around the Empire State Building, a Trumpzilla.
Oh, Trumpzilla.
It had been lashing its tail and knocking down a few neighboring buildings. And there was like a crisis. People were fleeing the city. It took me 3 hours to get here. Anyway, things are excellent.
Right to it, usual. Right to it. You see what I mean? No hesitation whatsoever.
What's that?
Nothing. Right to it. So, say hi to everybody.
Say hi, everybody.
I said hi already.
Hi, everybody. I'm sorry I was late. I left at 5:30. Should have been here 7:30, but just made it now. What? I'll get that down. Okay. All good. And what I have been thinking about the last couple of days is Srinika the Wanderer. There's a story in the Ashtasahasrika Prajnaparamita, the 8,000 line Prajnaparamita Sutra, about someone called an ascetic called Srinika the Wanderer. And Srinika the Wanderer is the only one of the few people in that literature, in that teaching, who attained the realization of emptiness, ultimate reality, and therefore non-duality, emptiness, relativity, by faith.
By?
Faith.
Faith.
Yes. Uh-huh. Not by reason, not by analysis, you know, not by vipassana, insight.
Uh-huh.
But by faith.
Faith.
Uh-huh. So, in anticipating working with you and having the joy of being with you and all of you, I was thinking about the sameness of faith and wisdom at some level. And then that made me think of our beloved friend Shyamdas and his stern critique of Shankaracharya of having a kind of dualistic non-duality.
Uh-huh.
in favor of Shuddhadvait, of the Vallabhacharya lineage of the Krishna Bhakti. Mm-hmm. You know, pure non-duality, instant non-duality, right here, this all being ultimate divinity, you know, right here and now, which is like the Buddhist idea of the reality body of the Buddha, the Dharmakaya, as it is called, the truth body or reality body of the Buddha, which from where anybody who ever became a Buddha, oh, there's the angel. Hello, how are you? When anybody becomes a Buddha, which all of us are doomed to become sooner or later, then we have an experience that we are everyone else, which is what makes it very much of a startling surprise. Because we think we're going to have like a big thing where we're going to be Buddha, and then we find out that everybody else is Buddha at the same time, because we are everybody else. But then this strange thing kicks in where we see everybody else as completely non-dual with us, but they're still themselves. And they're totally beautiful, and they're totally all right. They're totally embraced by Krishna, by Shiva, by Buddha, whoever it might be. And yet they are running around terrified of Trumpzilla and the many, many, many Trumpzillas that there have been in our planet and seem to be an endless supply of them, actually. And so then there's a funny thing where they're actually all right, and the Buddha perceives us all as completely bundles of clear light of the void, as they might call it, or bliss void, indivisible. You know, Shaivite might see us as, you know, Shiva, Shakti, and union, and every cell and every subatomic wave, particle, whatever. Or Krishna, Vala might see us as embraced in the beloved gopis of Krishna, you know. And yet, we don't know that yet. We somehow are insisting that we are separate from all of it, and we try to unify ourselves in this and that way. We seek some kind of union. And then different people in different ways, some think, oh, only it can be done by bhakti, by faith, because oneself is so imperfect. But the other one, the Krishna, the Buddha, the Shiva, the bliss void, indivisible of emptiness, etc., that's all pervading. So from that side, all I have to do is have faith in that and really drill down in the heart and go to the very center, subtle Buddha nature, Buddha womb, Buddha soul, which is the real self. And there, find that there's where there is already the awareness. We all already have the awareness there. But that awareness is locked away from our conventional awareness, habitual awareness, by our dualistic perception of imperfection and suffering and inadequacy and etc., our delusion, our ignorance, our misknowledge. So now the way in which I want to explain this, or I'm working and thinking about this, is when you realize that a mirror is a mirror, whenever at whatever age you were, when you reached into the mirror to reach the space that you saw as being on the other side through the window, and you thought there was a three-dimensional space in there, and you reached in, and then it clanked into the surface of the mirror. And then you realize that it's a reflection, and left and right are reversed, and there's some odd things about it, but it's just a reflection on the surface of this mirror. Then the person who's had a unitive experience with the ultimate in whatever language they approach it, Parama Atma, Nairatmya, Supreme Self, or selflessness, emptiness, or fullness, whatever they like to call it, they somehow realize the illusoriness of this differentiated world of insufficiency and problems and fears and aggressions and obsessions and depressions, are all, then they realize that all of those have disappeared into this union experience, then that's like realize that union experience becomes like the surface of some kind of inconceivably complex and exquisite and extraordinary mirror. And then because they don't stay apart forever, that's not possible, because they entered, so what enters exits in the relative state. But that's a deeper state, but it doesn't crush or destroy the surface state. So then, however, you, when you see the surface, experience yourself at the surface state as a differentiated, alienated, separated being, that experience is reflected in the mirror surface of this ultimate, loving, infinitely energetic, infinitely free, infinitely liberated reality, that it doesn't underlie. It may seem at first to underlie as if you leave one for the other, but eventually it is what constitutes the relativity, the differentiated level. It's what creates it, allows it to be there as a totally interrelated, you know, entangled swirl of beauty. So then after that, just like when you look in the mirror, you have an intuitive knowledge that this is just a reflection in the mirror. And you don't have to renew that knowledge by thinking through or repeating or conceptually remembering that it's a mirror. You intuitively know that it's a mirror. So Shuddhadvaita is that all of this lila, you know it's the play of Krishna. You know it's the vision of Shiva loving Uma, Shakti. And or you know it's the infinite love of the Dharmakaya, infinite compassion of infinite Buddhas for all of us infinite beings. So that faith is where you go beyond some concept and you give your heart to what you're having faith in. And that intuition also is just complete connection to that deeper reality. And a connection which does not smother or destroy your attention to the particulars of the differentiated plane, which, because you know that it is the same thing. It's the same plane. It's not outside of it. It's not, doesn't devalue that plane. It fulfills that plane. It embraces it. It loves it. Loves everything in it. Love meaning it provides the space for its freedom and happiness. So neither that intuition, wisdom intuition, nor that faith requires some kind of theory or concept in a way. Both go beyond theory, but both are the ultimately solid experience, actually. And that ultimately solid experience enfolds and sustains specific relative love and compassion and service and joy. And faith combined with music is so wonderful because then it brings the emotion along. So that's what I've been thinking about.
Yeah. I'll take two of those to go. What? I'll take two of those to go. Thank you.
Two in one.
Wow. you see? That's what I'm talking about. Maharaji said the same thing. He used to say, sub ek, all one. He didn't say it's all one or we're all one. You see, people argue about that all the time. Yes. It's not all one. He said all one.
Yeah.
Just all one.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And we kept trying to, we were so caught in our differentiated stuff, but it was his love and his presence that allowed us into the room where we could drop that. In fact, to get into that room, we just left it. We just walked out of it into that room, you know, over and over again. That's how he taught. He didn't teach with words and lectures.
Oh, good. Oh, yes.
You know?
Love everybody. Yeah. All one.
Yeah.
That's...
And
Sarvam Ekam.
Yeah. It wasn't a concept for him. It was 24/7, 365 and a quarter, I think it is.
So that means that we all have to direct our love and on the conventional level.
Yeah.
To the person who is much more anxious than any of us.
Much more anxious?
Yeah, much more frightened and anxious.
Absolutely.
Someone who has been living in his personal reality for a long time, in a gilded cage kind of. But now, this particular transition he's trying to make is into colliding with real reality.
Yeah.
And it's very frightening to him. And we are one with him. Guruji loves him.
Yeah.
I know we are very frightened of him. And we have reason to be on some conventional plane, definitely.
Yeah.
But he's more frightened than we are, actually.
Mm. Sure.
Because reality is hitting him. He made all these promises. It's going to be really great. It's going to be really great. It's going to be really great. Really, really, really great. Now, what? Yes, sir. Okay, it's going to be great. Well, what? Anyway.
Yeah.
As I said, he's wrapped around the Empire State Building, following in the steps of King Kong and Godzilla. Oh, dear. It's all right. You can come down now. Michelle will show you where the toilet is. You know the famous thing that Eisenhower and Kennedy, do you know that story?
No.
When Mamie and Eisenhower took John and Jacqueline, you know, introduced them to the White House.
Uh-huh.
And then they get in the car and they leave, you know, the tradition, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So then John Kennedy asked Dwight Eisenhower if he had any special precept, inner secret teaching about being president.
Uh-huh.
So Eisenhower said, most important thing, he said, son, never pass up a chance to relieve yourself.
I see. That's what Marilyn Monroe was all
That's
about.
That's a deep precept. That's a deep precept. Apparently, you know, you get in these long meetings, you know, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, boy.
Yeah. Did Michael tell you all about Menla and what it is?
Yep.
Who this is? And he's blue.
Oh, no, I didn't.
He's also blue like Krishna.
Mm.
You know, which is supposed to be the color of the monsoon thundercloud that brings the rain. You know?
You know what the name for that is? Sham.
Yeah, Sham, yes.
Sham, yeah.
Sham, yeah. Sham Das.
Sham Das. Sham.
Dear Sham. And in the Buddhist thing, the blue is called ultimate reality, perfection, wisdom. It's a sapphire color. They say lapis, but then they say it's translucent, and lapis is not translucent.
That's right.
So it has to be a sapphire color.
Mm-hmm.
And that's actual wisdom, which is the transmutation of hatred, actually. And hatred as a poison connects to intelligence. Because, you know, intelligence wants to get to the bottom of what it is and find out what it is and take it apart, you know. So intelligence is like a fire that burns through the superficial appearance of things and wants to see the real reality of it, you know, the fire of wisdom. Mm-hmm. And so for the egocentric, you know, deluded person driven by their unconscious, then that poison called hatred or anger, you know, fury, etc., becomes intelligence, becomes ultimate reality, perfection, wisdom, because it sees through all of the things and it discovers that the reality is perfect already, has always been, you know, mm-hmm. and that's a deep blue-black type color, you know.
Mm.
It's a central channel, Rahu, you know. It's just always been perfect, you know. So if any of us has any experience of feeling that anything's imperfect, like we're sitting too much in one position, we get a pain over here, we have a painful knee or something wrong, then that's because we are dealing with the illusory level of the reality, and the ultimate reality is perfect. So the deity that is blue color, like that, a dark blue color, means that they're grounded in this ultimate reality. It's why they're black, black and blue, blue-black. It's like dark, you know, Parker's blue-black ink, you know. It's that color, like Krishna, right? And out of that darkness, it's like the scientists, the poor male chauvinist modern scientists, mostly, but except for a few women, right? The one woman in Cambridge discovered dark matter and dark energy, which is 97% of what's here. This bright male stuff is only 3%. So, never mind. I'm not going to start crying because we don't have a mom in the White House. I wanted to have a mom. But we don't really have. But we have another father. So that's a blue color. So anyway, when Buddha looked out at the suffering of beings, to subliminally reassure them, he radiated this blue light, and he turned this dark blue light. And it's always radiating, and it's like almost invisible because it's like dark. But yet it's a light. And that's the ultimate healing light, you know, like a cobalt dark light. And because he's like only present, manifests a presence out of being a field of oneness with all of those suffering beings, because that he manifested as a beacon of the fact that they have healing within them. And there is a deeper level where they're actually all healed already, which they will discover sooner or later. And so it's called Menla, which Baishajya Guru in Sanskrit. Baishajya means medicine. Guru means teacher of medicine. And he has a medical immortality thing in the bowl. And then he holds in his right hand, which is down like that, in the boon-granting gesture, giving of gift, fulfilling your wishes gesture. He holds a plant. Which signals to us that the plant world has the healing. It matches us, the animal world, the moving people. The unmoving plant world has everything we need. You know, and we give it some. We give it that nice carbon dioxide that it likes. It gives us back oxygen and every kind of medicine. So that's the aru plant, you know, aru, baru, kuru. It's the myrobalan plant, you know. Special healing plant that grows in India and grows in heaven, they say, you know. So this place is supposed to be a place where when you come through that gate in the front there, you're supposed to feel 100% better right away.
Okay, let's go do it again.
And then you meet, then you see, you listen to KD, and then you're 200% better. And that's the image that we're meditating. And Dalai Lama, of course, has the place. He was here one night. He was supposed to be two.
I was here that time.
And they stole him the second night. He was supposed to be here two nights. And I asked him how he slept. And he said it was the best sleep he ever had in North America.
Really? Wow.
I don't know what happened in South America. Must have been really great. But it was the best sleep he ever had in North America.
Wow. Wow.
On this great place. Yeah. And I asked out of concern because he said he met with a great Naga here.
Yeah.
There's a big, huge Naga here, he said, which has to do Guru's with the water Naga. Coming up above the mountain. Yes, yeah, so a very benevolent, nice Naga, peaceful Naga. But a Naga. You know?
Yeah. Michael
and, Phillips. You know, the Nagas, if they're happy, Nagas are tremendous blessing beings, you know. They saved the Mahayana Sutras. 400 or 500 years from Buddha's time under the ocean, in the Mahayana myth, imaginaire, you know, or reality. So Nagas are really great. They're like serpents or dragons, right?
Yeah.
Naga.
Yeah.
And he had a big bowl of milk, this big, he was offering to the Naga.
Yeah.
And we do pujas to that Naga.
I remember we were sitting, the room was set up differently that day.
What's that?
The room was set up differently when His Holiness was here. He was sitting over
right,
there.
Right, right.
And I was sitting there, and there were a long line of Rinpoches sitting there. And His Holiness was sitting there, and people were making noise and talking and everything and getting ready. Finally, His Holiness just looked over at Gelug Rinpoche and said, "Rinpoche!" All of a sudden, everybody's chanting. He said, "Rinpoche!" It was so funny.
He was very happy. But he was a little disconcerted by the longevity, one of the longevity experiments, because we had those doctors who were doing longevity. That one lady, Elizabeth Blackburn,
mm-hmm.
she got a Nobel Prize afterwards for having discovered the telomeres.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the cell that creates longevity, the cap on the cell.
Mm-hmm.
But then another one had this thing where they had slides showing two mouses sewed together, you know, their circulatory system sewed together. And it was where the organs of the young one rejuvenated the old one, you know.
Oh, really? Oh.
So His Holiness muttered to me in a Tibetan, said, "Maybe I better have myself sewn to you." And I said, "I'm sorry, Your Holiness, I'm not young enough." And it wouldn't do either of us any good. He laughed. But then he actually sort of stuck his tongue out. He didn't like that look of those mice.
You know, yeah, yeah.
Like that. And then the lady who was giving that talk, the researcher, she said, "I didn't do that experiment. I'm just showing a slide."
Yeah.
She realized he was uncomfortable.
Yeah, yeah, sure. That's hard to see. That's funny.
And I did actually say to her, I said, "No, they don't sew themselves, but in America sometimes the wealthy older men attach themselves to some younger female." I did say. And then he kind of looked, he didn't didn't go for that.
You remember,
he's
I don't know.
Earthy fellow, you know.
Oh, he is funny. You know, really earthy. I just want to tell this, Holiness story. We were in Phoenix at that place on the top of the hill.
Oh, yeah, the anger one.
Yeah. And he did a whole teaching for 3 or 4 days, I think it was, on bodhicitta and kindness and everything. In the last session, he took questions from people, and Jinpa was reading the questions to His Holiness. One of the questions was, "Your Holiness, I did something to hurt somebody once."
Oh, yeah.
Remember this?
Yeah, I do.
And I've apologized over and over. Year after year, I keep apologizing, and the person does not accept my apology. What should I do? And this is, remember, all these teachings were on kindness and compassion and caring. So His Holiness says, "You keep apologizing. 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, you keep apologizing. 4 years, they don't accept your apology. Tell them to go to hell."
But there is one.
No, wait. I'm going to tell it. I'm going to tell it.
All right.
So all of a sudden, I thought to myself, His Holiness the Dalai Lama does not tell people to go to hell, because if he did, they would, and he doesn't really want that.
Exactly. Right?
So I asked Bob, I said, "What did he really say?" Bob said to me, "He said, tell him to eat shit."
That's right. Gyakpa So in Tibetan, it's a very, Gyakpa So.
That's
eat shit. But the translator.
It's like we say go to hell.
The translator was embarrassed to say that.
Yeah.
For whatever reason, so he used what he'd heard a lot of Westerners say, who lightly say that because they don't believe there's such a place.
That's right. Yeah, that's right.
So everybody's all go to hell, go to hell. We all say because we don't think it really is a place. But His Holiness would never say to anybody, go to hell. They don't say that in Tibetan language because they do think there's 32 hells, and they're very vividly described. And you don't say to somebody you should go there, anybody, not even any Zillas or anybody. No, you don't. So he just said, "Eat shit." That was, you know, Gyakpa So. It's innocent sounding in Tibetan. Gyakpa So.
Innocent in Tibetan.
I have another one in this vein about His Holiness. When we were at one of those science conferences, actually one that we arranged.
Mind Life?
No, before Mind and Life.
Oh, before?
We were proto-Mind and Life.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, like protozoa, you know, we were proto-Mind and Life. So We had one at MIT, and there was a guy, a Western American scientist, who was doing addiction thing. Mm-hmm. And in addiction thing, he was telling His Holiness that he had developed a thing where he could stimulate with electrical somehow a certain place in the brain, and the person who was thus stimulated, the subject, experimental subject, would have a strong feeling of pleasure with no content. Mm-hmm. So just by stimulating the brain, you know, sure. Which of course for them is proving that the brain is the mind and all this, right? Yeah. But His Holiness wasn't getting to that issue. Mm-hmm. But he was thrilled about it. So I was so excited about it. Huh. So we didn't really know why. And then we went to the green room and, you know, there was a break, you know, between sessions. We went to the green room. Jimbo was still a monk at that time. And he had his robe on and everything.
Long time ago.
So then His Holiness is just flipped out. There's a story in the Vinaya about a monk who was raped by an recent ex-nun, who must have been a female mud wrestler or something. She was a lot stronger than him. Uh-huh. And she got him down and she made love with him. Because she'd been in love with him, I guess, from afar when she was a nun, you know, and then she couldn't stand anymore and she resigned as a nun. And then she waited and laid and waited for this monk who she had the hots for. And she grabbed him down. And she did that. His Holiness was telling his story. And then the other monks, he had sex. He ejaculated even. He had sex. And dragged him to the Buddha, you know, in the confession twice a month. And then Buddha asked him, like, well, did you get into it yourself? He said, no way. I was completely out of my body. I don't know what happened to my body. She had charge of it. I didn't bother. I was not there. The monk said. And Buddha said, I believe you. You stay in. You remain a monk. You're in the order. I don't eject you. Uh-huh. And the other monks were outraged. And for 2,500 years, they've been debating this argument in total this and that. And apparently, Holiness was on the side that Buddha was right, because many think Buddha made a mistake or he had favoritism to this monk or something like that. And His Holiness was thrilled. He said, "Neuroscience proves." That monk was not in the content of making love with that nun. He was just being abused. But his body automatically had the erection, even the ejaculation.
What a concept.
He was not into it. So then there's a guy sitting over there from the MIT.
Yeah.
This is all going on in Tibetan. Excitement. His Holiness is really tripped out about solved the 1,000-year-old problem. And the guy, then His Holiness says to Jimba, tell him what we're talking about. The guy was looking like open mouthed at this intense Tibetan conversation. We're solving the universe. And Jimbo says, no, I don't want to tell him. He's all flushing red.
Oh, wow.
He's still a monk. So then I tell him, well, His Holiness, and I told him a story. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
I had a hard on, he ejaculated, and this. And the guy's like, I couldn't believe that the Dalai Lama was so much concerned with the reality.
Yeah. Right.
And he looked down in the future, saw this long partnership between neuroscience and Tibetan Vinaya, the ethical.
Yeah, sure.
The monastic ethical thing, the fantastic partnership.
Wow.
That's what he did.
You know, that brings up a point, you know, the difference between Western monasticism and Eastern monasticism. I feel the monks that I've met in the East, they know what life's about. They're not hiding from the realities of sex.
But they're not monks. These are Western words. Monasticism, monk, ordained. Those are all Western Christian words.
Achcha.
When you become a full mendicant. Bhikshu means a mendicant.
Uh-huh.
So it's like means a dropout. Thousands of years before Tim Leary, it means a dropout. And because that society was so generous, Indian society,
yeah,
and was so wealthy,
yeah,
and they had a lot of food, and they didn't have ice boxes.
Right.
So they were happy to give it away. So therefore, it was a merit to give it away. Uh-huh. So when people would meet the Buddha and they would feel his vibe, that he was like totally self-satisfied. He had like total flow in his body. He was a flowing being, right? And all the later arhats became like that. They were all flowing beings. Mm. So when they would feel that, they would say, oh, why am I plowing this field? Why am I doing that? Why am I raising this child, female or male? They wanted to join that.
Mm.
And they just became mendicants. And then they opened up their sensibility. And by reversing that sort of deep craving for the set date on a Saturday night, mm-hmm. or whatever, mm-hmm. they had that energy flowing throughout the whole system.
Mm.
In fact,
right.
and especially the women.
The whole system. That's the
yes,
key.
Yes, the yeah. whole system, not yeah. just genitally organized, you know, orgasm, and, like Freud might talk about.
And versa versa, not just everything but.
Orgasm.
Yeah, sure, absolutely.
Brain orgasm, throat yeah. orgasm, heart orgasm, navel orgasm, earlobe orgasm. So the point is that
yeah.
that there are mendicants. When you get to be a full member of a mendicant, it's called graduation.
Huh.
It's considered a privilege. It's not a deprivation.
Right.
And especially for the women. Now, the modern feminist scholars of Buddhism get really freaked out about Buddha because he resisted two times to have a female mendicant order
right.
or community.
Right.
It's actually, even the word order is wrong.
Uh-huh.
See, the order and ordination, all that comes from the fact that in Western and Christian monasticism, the first virtue of a monk or a nun is obedience.
Uh-huh.
And the obedience goes to the abbot,
yeah.
abbot to the pope to God, or
right,
Jesus
right,
and
right.
God. Right.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's the hierarchy
mm-hmm.
of obedience.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a mention of obedience in Buddhist mendicancy.
Uh-huh.
It's freedom.
Mm.
And so when you're a mendicant, you don't have to worry about your bank account. You don't have to worry about mm-hmm. your mortgage. You don't have to worry about which Godzilla is on the throne.
Mm.
You just go and get free food.
Yeah.
And you limit it. You have a big lunch at 11 a.m.
Right.
And you limit it to that so that they don't get over, you know, you don't demand dinner.
Right.
Or breakfast, just lunch.
Yeah.
Free lunch.
Mm-hmm.
Free lunch. The wonderful, generous India, you know.
Yes.
So, and oh yeah, and the prime minister are mad at him because he didn't immediately embrace all the women, but they said, well, can't women get enlightenment? He said, oh, yeah, they can get enlightenment more easily because they're more advanced than men in the compassion department,
uh-huh.
in the sense of connectedness department.
Right.
He said, it's easier for them. But if we open up to a female mendicancy order, the overall community will have a lesser longevity.
Yeah.
And the reason is so many will want to join, more than the men. And there was a total flood. Because why? In the patriarchal family system,
terrible.
You're married 8, you start bearing children at 13, you bear them continuously until you're worn out in your early 20s. And then the guy you marry is arranged some like, there's a one nun, you know, the one nun song, I forgot her name, but she says, oh, Buddha, if this isn't nirvana, it's close enough. I just had lunch under a tree, free lunch.
Yeah.
I didn't have to cook it, prepare it, harvest it, anything. I have only the one bowl. I don't have to wash the bowl. I just wipe it out, put it back in my little jhola. And you helped me, Buddha, you helped me escape from 3 crooked things. My rice pounding pestle, that I pounded the husks off the rice.
Mm-hmm.
My bent over old mother-in-law. And my hunchbacked husband.
Wow.
Thank you, Buddha.
Wow.
This is nirvana for me, she said. She didn't even say, we don't know if she was really in nirvana,
yeah,
she
yeah.
realized she was in nirvana or not, but she said that was close enough.
Right.
So there was a total stampede, as he predicted. And they're much better mendicants, and they achieve their stages very quickly.
Sure.
Of course. We know we can see that in America. They're more advanced than us.
Yeah.
Right? Do you agree?
Absolutely.
There you go. Absolutely. He knows which side he's buttered on. Me too. and because the compassion is the thing. If this is the ultimate reality here and now, if we are in the embrace of Krishna, then we are connected to everyone. Inevitably, there's no escape. We're all entangled forever. And it's harder for us males to know that than it is for you females. That's why in America, they're way ahead in all the orders and all the meditation groups, and they are really the best, right?
Yeah.
They are.
Yeah.
Guys are struggling alone.
Absolutely. Maharaji used to say,
what?
Maharaji used to say, one sati, or pure woman, is worth 1,000 yogis.
Really?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Over and over, he always said
he's
that.
He's the
yeah.
best. Love everybody. He's so great. He's very good. I like his pose over there. He has like a really nice knee thing.
Yeah. It's hard to do.
He must not have pain in his knees.
He could,
did he have knee pain?
No, no. You know, he could put his arms flat on the ground like this and do a complete somersault without picking them up.
What?
Yeah. He had 360 degrees he could do.
Really?
Oh, yeah. He used to do that when he was younger all the time. He used to entertain the school kids so they would give him their lunches.
Really?
Yeah. He'd come out of the jungle and play with the
jungle. How would he do that? You mean he would put his hand and then he'd flip his whole body around like shoulder
yeah,
joint?
Yeah, yeah. Mr. Tiwari told me that. He saw it himself many times.
Can you do that? You're Mahayogini? Can you do that? And you teach people how to do that? Right. Oh, yeah, I'll give you lunch.
I'll give you my socks.
I sure will. That sounds amazing.
Yeah. He used to do all kinds of things like that. He would twist himself in all kinds of shapes and everything.
No, I was telling somebody, it's kind of weird, you know. Your beloved guru and my original beloved guru, although he would never admit to being a guru.
Huh.
He refused.
Really?
He said, I'm not taking, don't give me this guru crap, he said. It's not good for you. It's not good for me. He would always say that.
Mm.
He said, because sometimes if I say scold you or say something and you get mad at me, then that's a great sin for you. So what I really appreciate if someone feels I'm their friend, he used to say.
Mm-hmm.
It was so great. Yeah. He always stepped out of using the guru little trick, little dominating guru trick, you know.
Yeah.
He did.
Yeah.
You know, he really did. It was really great. But anyway, these two guys starred in Ram Dass's Be Here Now. They were both in that book.
Which two guys?
Oh, Keshavanga.
Yeah, sure. Neshavanga.
He had this transmission
when
his car ran out of gas in the East Side Tunnel. Remember, Ram Dass was driving in his little green Mercedes, and he was still Richard Alpert there, and then the car ran out of gas, and he was all panicked in the driver's seat. Keshavanga was snoozing, sitting in the right side. Don't you remember that story? Well, he used to go there a lot because of a friend of his who Keshavanga was trying to help.
Right, right.
Who had gone a little wacky.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. We heard about
one dose too many.
Yeah, one dose, at least one dose too many. Yeah.
Anyway. So anyway, California has now legalized pot. And they're going to secede.
They're going to secede?
They might.
Mm. Okay.
If Rudy Giuliani becomes not district attorney, attorney general.
Oh, my God in heaven.
Okay. It's going to be rough.
Yeah. Yeah, really. It will be, huh? Nevada and Massachusetts also.
But luckily, they'll keep trying to arrest Hillary. And even now they're saying they want to arrest Obama. They want to arrest Obama.
Who's saying that?
The followers of Trump.
Sure.
They want to arrest him. I don't know why. They just had a very civil 45-minute thing, and Trumpzilla said he needed Obama's counsel.
Mm.
And the White House, they went to the White House already.
Mm. Yeah. There's nothing worse than followers.
Than what?
There's nothing worse than followers.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's just...
Well, that's true. Yeah. We could have used a few more, though, the other day.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So here we are, right? This is a direct experience of reality.
It is.
No, there's nothing going on, just life right here.
That's right.
And I'm happy to be here. I'm happy to be here.
You can't explain it, but you can experience it. That's the greatest thing about it.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
It is one of the greatest things about it.
So
let's sing for a little bit.
Oh, here they come.
Here they come.
the Gandharvas.
I took some clear light once.
This next number is the Lilabai.
The Lilabai.
The Lilabai.
Sing a Lilabai. Mm-hmm.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up now that spring is here, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. So what's the right amount of socializing for you? Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. It's a great way to build relationship skills, figure out your goals, and so much more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beherenow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/beherenow.